Hello and welcome to Moaz. When was the last time you thought about the labels we give people on the move? Some have positive meanings, and others, strong negative connotations. Labels can influence change, or they can target and exclude. They can also, in the adapted words of Robert Cox, be used for someone and to serve a purpose. In this podcast, we're looking at how labels in migration are constructed, their limitations, and how the people given them feel. You might be thinking asylum seeker, refugee, migrant, the three main words in the lexicon of migration. Easy! Asylum seekers are people fleeing one country and seeking asylum in another country. Refugees are those recognized for fleeing because of persecution, war, or other forms of violence. Migrants are not refugees. They chose to leave their homes for a better life, work, or education, and they can leave at any time. But it's not that simple. Categories don't fit everyone's experiences, and that's difficult for people drafting migration policy and those given them. Also, be sure to check out the first in a series called Things You Didn't Know. It's about the countries that people Moaz has rescued have come from. Professor Heaven Crawley has been investigating these categories for several years now, and she says there's problems with them. Their construction fails to see how people's reasons for leaving change. They're also deeply political, and the debate behind them unfairly discriminates between those seen as deserving of rights and protection.
As part of the research, we interviewed 215 people who'd crossed to Greece from Turkey. We also interviewed another nearly 300 people in Italy and elsewhere, and many of the findings were similar. But they were very different in terms of the nationality. So most of the people we interviewed in Greece were from Syria, from Afghanistan and Iraq. In fact, these countries alone made up nearly 90% of the people who arrived in Greece during 2015. Now, these are countries where there's very well documented conflict and human rights abuse, particularly Syria. So half the people we interviewed were from Syria. And they, of course, gave us very detailed accounts of the civil war that's been raging in Syria since March 2011 and the consequences for themselves and their families. Now, because we interviewed people, particularly on the island of Lesbos, when they had literally just arrived, sometimes they'd been on the island for maybe a few hours or a day or two, they were often at that point unaware of the significance of the labels that would be applied to their experiences. They simply, in a way, believed that they needed to tell their experiences, to relay their stories, and that they would be provided with protection. Many of them were not aware of the asylum system or that there was a particular set of regulations regarding refugees. And we, in our research, were very careful not to use the labels because we're very conscious that those labels have come to represent certain things about the legitimacy or otherwise of the claims that are being made. So I think it's really only once people are in Europe for a period of time, and it may be days or weeks, it could be months, but they come to realise that the systems are structured very differently for refugees and migrants, and that they are required to tell their story, not just in a straightforward, this is what happened to me way, but in a way that fits with and conforms with assumptions about what a refugee is or looks like.
What do these categories, as we currently understand them, tell us about the people coming to Europe and how they're perceived?
So over the last few years, and particularly since 2015, we've seen a very intense political and policy and media debate in Europe about the arrival of increasingly large numbers of refugees and migrants across the Mediterranean in boats primarily. And in that context, there has been a lot of concern that people are not really refugees seeking protection, but are actually using the refugee convention, if you like, to circumvent immigration controls in order to be able to come and work in different countries in Europe. So we've had this idea that you have, on the one hand, refugees who, if you like, are good migrants because they have legitimate reasons to be able to cross the Mediterranean. On the other hand, people who are perceived as using the asylum route as a way to gain access to work are perceived as bad migrants. They are irregular, illegal, and manipulating in some way the system. The problem is that in our research, and we've conducted research with many of the people making these journeys, the reality of their stories is a much more complicated one. They often started, for example, in Syria, because of the conflict, leaving their homes, but then found themselves unable to make a livelihood in countries like Turkey or Lebanon or Jordan. And equally, people who left countries in West Africa, perhaps looking for economic opportunity, found themselves in a country like Libya, where there is now well-documented and extreme human rights abuses of one kind or another. So this idea that there are good and bad migrants or good and bad refugees doesn't map well onto the lived experiences of the people who actually arrive on the shores of Europe.
You point out that organisations focused on migration are educating the public on the differences between refugees and migrants, and that privileges one group of people over another.
One of the responses to the very negative political and media debate that we have seen, particularly over the last few years, but actually it's been evolving over the last decade or more, has been this vilification of the refugee, particularly the asylum seeker, someone who's not yet got status, but the refugee in general. And so people have tried to remind people that actually refugees are coming from very particular backgrounds. They have very specific experiences. They've often experienced hardship and extreme loss in some cases, losing very many family members, for example, or themselves being tortured in quite horrific ways. So in order to try and, if you like, get more empathy, more sympathy, more understanding of why people might choose or decide to leave their homes and come to Europe, many organisations have pointed out that a refugee has not only got specific rights under international law, but also never wanted to leave their country in the first place, were forced to leave, and that they need protection, they need our support because of that. Unfortunately, in constructing that narrative, in my view, the economic migrants, that category that is defined in that way, has often been positioned as being somehow less deserving or in need of protection, that these are just people who left for work, that somehow because of that, because they couldn't feed their families, because they might starve to death, that's somehow not as deserving as a refugee. And with the negative media discourse, those narratives, those distinctions have become very problematic for two reasons. One is that actually the vast majority of people who are moving are migrants, not refugees. And also there is this slippage between refugees and migrants in terms of their experiences, as I've explained. But the second reason why is that actually, ultimately, these categories are very artificial. These are human beings who have moved. And as human beings who have moved, they are entitled to rights, as human beings, regardless of whether they are refugees or migrants. So if we want to really centre rights in the narrative about what's important in the world that we live in, then having this distinction between some people having more or less rights than others, which is true in a legal sense for refugees, but not true in terms of human rights, I think that's very problematic. And I think all of us would, if and when we meet somebody who's left initially for economic reasons, but then suffered extreme hardship and poverty and perhaps persecution on the way, and now is in a situation of having no rights at all, we would find it hard to argue that they shouldn't have rights. And the fact that they may be categorically defined as a migrant doesn't change that fact. They still are entitled to rights under international law. So that's why I think it's problematic. I realise it's very challenging because we have very few ways at the moment of trying to recapture some of the things that we think are important in terms of migration. But I don't think this is a solution.
So migrants to Europe are packaged into convenient categories which are recognisable and easily referred to with a label. But experiences and journeys don't necessarily fit them. It makes some more deserving, giving them rights, a right to be there, and infers who's good and who's bad. A few podcasts ago, we spoke to Tarek Ismail, a refugee from Syria. He'd arrived in Erfurt, Germany, and was granted a 3-year residency permit. He's working now and looking to study at the university. How does he feel about the label he's been given?
It means a lot. A word refugee. The person, when he comes as a refugee, it takes many, many meanings according to the situation of this person. But let me talk about my country. When I say a Syrian refugee, It means a lot. It means war. It means a person feels himself insecure. It means a person who's ready to do any kind of work, even working for 15 hours a day just to get a safe place for him and for his family. It means a lot of bad memories in his mind, a lot of drama in the country where he was living. It's a lot, actually. It's a lot of negative stuff. It needs a lot of time to talk about it.
Some integration organizations and migrants to Germany have pointed out that there's too much focus on numbers and groups and not individuals. Have you felt this way?
Let me say, it's just an opinion. For me, it's just related to the way the men think about the society and the way he reacts with this society. For me, let me say, at the beginning, yes, I felt like that because we were all refugees and the German people were dealing with us as a new people who they don't know about them anything. But after 2 years, I have got so many friends. I sit in the cafe, let me say every 2 minutes, I must meet someone I know from the German people or from the refugees or from any part of the society. And I feel like I am one of them. I'm not a number.
Marhaban, and welcome to the first in a series of short looks at things you didn't know about countries the people we rescue come from. First up is Yemen. In the last 3 years, we've saved several people from Yemen, and they describe a deteriorating situation there. In ancient times, it was called Arabia Felix, the Happy Land. Ironic, given the conflict tearing apart the country. Political factions backed by rebels and neighboring states are competing for control. The human cost is considerable. Since 2015, over 180,000 people have fled the country, while almost 2 million are displaced. Two-thirds of the population, that's 17 million people, face a daily fight to find food. That's while 500,000 suffer from cholera, the world's largest single outbreak. It hasn't stopped people from Somalia and Ethiopia trying to get there. The short distance between the Horn of Africa and Yemen and the instability caused by the civil war make it ideal for those heading to Saudi Arabia for work. 55,000 have made the crossing so far this year. Those are the lucky ones. When smugglers spot police, they deliberately drown those on board. It's ongoing, with IOM reporting that 50 migrants died this way in August. Now let's go beyond the current crisis and explore Yemen. Music is a large part of Yemeni culture, and centuries of trade with the Middle and Far East have helped. Its traditional music is called humani, a kind of lyrical poetry which dates back to the 14th century. Fast forward to today, and Yemen is big on hip-hop. It's been growing over the last decade thanks to Yemeni-American rapper AJ, also known as Hajjaj Masjid. He raps about local issues and duets with Yemeni artists to spread the need for change. Yemen's first rap music festival was in 2009. What costs $240 per pound, tastes like chocolate, but isn't? Yemeni coffee. You can trace coffee's first international trade to Yemen. Beans were grown on the 800-year-old hillside terraces of Haraz, with the first shipments leaving the port of Mocha in the 1400s. That's according to Mukhtar al-Khanshali, the founder of a Yemeni coffee startup called Port of Mocha. Bringing a coffee business back to life isn't easy, though. A competing crop for farmers is a drug called cat, and it soaks up almost half of the country's scarce water supply. For every one farm producing coffee, there are seven producing cat. So next time you ask for mocha or arabica, you'll know where it came from. There's more to Yemeni dress than meets the eye. Men in the north wear a thub. It's a traditional long dress which comes in a variety of colours and styles. On the coast and east, you'll see men in futas or mawas, These are more like a wraparound skirt worn for different occasions. There's also a macheda. It's a type of shawl worn on the head. You can tell which region you're from by the way it's wrapped. And to complete the look, there's the dark suit jacket and the all-important Yemeni dagger, the jambiya. It's a symbol of wealth and manhood. Women are more conservative to conform to Islamic teachings. In the last decade and a half, more and more women are wearing a black dress called a balto, which goes over other clothes. In Sana'a, you'll see women wearing a large piece of cloth called a sitara. Yemen hasn't escaped Western lifestyle. Young Yemenis sport fashionable jeans and suits. Now, one of Yemen's most surprising features is its city of mud. On its floodplain is a place the British explorer and travel writer Freya Stark once called the Manhattan of the desert. Shibam is a 16th century walled metropolis of buildings, built from mud and hay bricks, some rising as high as 11 stories. But it wasn't just built to look good. From the tight passageways, interconnected bridges, its walls, and even its position in the wadi, Shibam let the people inside see who was coming and stop them getting in. Today, the city faces new threats. Wind, rain, heat, erosion, and bombs from the civil war raging around it are damaging the city. In 2015, it was listed by UNESCO as one of the 54 heritage sites in the world currently under threat. That concludes our miniature look at Yemen. Next time, we're looking at Nigeria. Now, let's take you back to our discussion of labels in migration. We're reminding people that new people don't need a new identity. That's Vitaly Polushnikov, one of the founders of I'm Not a Refugee. Where the Luxembourgish project focuses on the personal stories of people, this side wants to put profession before status. Their website has signed up just over 50 people from various walks of life. Activists, artists, chefs, sports people, to name a few.
I've been lucky to have a few conversations with the people directly, and to point out a few stories, I'll definitely mention Yara, who is an artist. She moved from Syria to Amsterdam, and actually the best part of the story is that she became the designer of the refugee nation flag. We found out recently that in some way the I'm Not a Refugee project was part of the link there. Yeah, but it's great that a small project was part of another project. So yeah, Yara's story is definitely worth mentioning. There's Imad, who's actually a good friend of mine now. He lives in Stockholm. He wrote a children's book for refugees. And he actually dedicated a few years of his life traveling around and writing the book. It's definitely another worthy project. Then there's Muhab, who's a developer. And we spoke maybe a year and a half ago. At the time, he found a job in Berlin. And I'm not sure what he's doing these days, but I'm sure he's professionally in the right spot. And I'm actually thinking now that it might maybe a good idea to update the story a bit and see where people are at 2 years later.
How did they feel being called refugees?
I'd say generally most people we spoke with, they understood the perspective from different sides, and it's been definitely something that has been like in the back of their heads. And I would actually use the word annoying when it's overused and when it's the first strong impression. But from real experience speaking with people, I think everyone just wants to drop that story, maybe mention a little bit and just move on. Because if you're only going to talk about the refugee story, then you're always relating to the past. Whereas I think people just want to move on and start building a new relation with anyone they meet and basically start writing a new story. And that's how people communicate. Yeah, so I would say the word refugee is definitely something that people face, but it's something they want to skip entirely.
Professor Heaven Crawley argues that current policies towards refugees favour them over migrants. Should refugees be more deserving than migrants?
So I actually think that it depends, first of all, if people want to be treated differently. So if you're a refugee, you should have the right to choose if you want to be perceived as a migrant. And then it's your choice and you should be normal migrant. But if the situation is quite different and you may need some extra attention, then that should be right as well. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that if you are a refugee, it doesn't mean that you have to be treated as a refugee by default.
From one project focused on refugees ridding themselves of a label to one that wants them to own them, I Am a Refugee allows refugees to reclaim their label, reimagining them in positive ways. It started last year and follows on from a previous campaign focused on immigrants. Sarah Marcus is the Communications Director for the Joint Council for the Welfare of Immigrants.
I think labels are very important to anybody who works in kind of the refugee and migrant support or advocacy sector in this country, or probably throughout Western Europe and the States as well, because that labels, to a large degree, negative labels are what is behind the resistance to helping and supporting these people, and not just helping and supporting, but embracing the wealth and the creativity and the advantages that newcomers to our countries bring. Changing those labels and taking them away and helping, I guess, the public to see refugees and immigrants and newcomers as individuals rather than the sort of amorphous mass of people just kind of coming and wanting help, which is not really the truth at all, is very important. And so in every sort of bit of public-facing work that we do, I suppose we are trying to take those labels away. So clearly, take them away or sort of reclaim them, I suppose, because we actually have two very kind of boldly titled campaigns, if you like. I Am an Immigrant, I Am a Refugee. So it's allowing the immigrants and the refugees to claim those labels and turn them around. And rather than them being used as terms of abuse or negative terms, to sort of allow the people to own them and to reimagine them really as positive terms. But also we are very careful to always remind people not to talk about illegal immigrants, which of course is a very widely bandied about term, and people use it without even thinking, and it's completely awful term, because as we always say, you know, no a person cannot be illegal, only an act can be illegal. So we never use that term, and we try and take that term out of the public discourse as well.
Can you give me an idea of the types of people or even the things or traditions that you have listed as refugees or contributions from refugees?
So we have a huge range of people in our campaign. There are 9 sort of ambassadors who are high profile people. Some are alive, some are not. And they were kind of the ambassadors for the campaign. So we made these plaques in the style of English heritage plaques, sort of telling the stories of their lives, and we put them up on buildings where they had lived or worked. But then we also have an art exhibition with many more of those plaques, but they're not actually physical plaques, just images of them, with many more people. And then we have even more refugees featured on our website. We have sports people, scientists, writers, singers, artists, doctors, lots and lots of campaigners, really people from all walks of life. Also, it's important to note that on the website, we have a lot of supporters. So we specifically created a function whereby people could make a plaque online. The public can go online and create their own virtual plaque, which where their name goes and it says, "I support refugees." So I suppose with our online site, we wanted to create somewhere where we could bring the refugees and their supporters together and show that there was a lot of support out there for refugees as well. And in terms of the traditions. Campaign doesn't feature sort of cultural traditions as such, but I think one theme that is reflected in the plaques, both the physical ones and the online ones and the ones in our art exhibition, are the sort of common values and common way of living that many of these refugees have developed, probably as a result of the experiences they've gone through. So when you read their stories in our campaign, what you see is a common tenacity and determination that they share. You kind of read that they fled these shocking circumstances and then they've come to this country and they've contributed so much. They've gotten over their horrendous experiences and really given so much back to Britain. And so it's not a tradition per se, but that is sort of a common thing that is reflected, I think, in the exhibition.
We focused a lot on refugees, but what about economic migrants? As we found, individuals' experiences can blur the categories between migrants and refugees. Right now, economic migrants still don't have a legal definition. Here's Professor Heaven Crawley again.
There are various efforts to try and formalise, if you like, what we might mean by an economic migrant. And there are certainly work by the International Labour Organizations, by others, to create conventions around rights for economic migrants. The Office for the High Commissioner for Human Rights is currently working very hard on a rights-based framework for economic migration in the context, in particular, of the UN Global Compact process. But no, it's true that there is no definition, precise definition of economic migrant, really because that category is so broad as to be meaningless. Because, of course, even if someone moves for reasons of persecution, they still have to eat. They still have to survive and feed themselves. So they still have to engage in economy in some way. So at the moment we have, you know, an economic migrant could be a very highly skilled, very highly qualified, very rich businessman moving between multinationals, or it could be someone who moves irregularly from Bangladesh to India. There is no commonality between those. So that's the one problem. And the second problem is that states ultimately have sovereignty over whom they allow to enter their countries and remain for economic purposes. Asylum is different because international refugee law requires them to not simply return people, but to take account of their circumstances and to provide surrogate protection if necessary. That's not the case with economic migrants. So states are very, very protective, particularly now, about allowing there to be anything universal about the definition of an economic migrant, or for there to be any requirement for them to take economic migrants. And any efforts to move into regularising that at a global level has been resisted very strongly, even though, in practical terms, people are moving around globally between international corporations, for example, all the time. So I don't think there's any immediate sign of these issues resolving. The issue then becomes, how do we make sure that people who are in the countries as workers get the rights they need and deserve? And that's a slightly different issue than about the category they fit into.
We've learned that labels in migration are very tricky tools. Their definitions are constructed on narratives that are easy to use, but ultimately miss the reality of people's experiences. This means they are either good or bad, more deserving and less deserving of rights. We've also heard how labels are also an identity. Some argue that newcomers don't need identities, and others that they can own their label and the positivity that they can generate with it. Ultimately, the ideal would be as Tarek found it, a member of society. If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. You can follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can support our rescue missions by giving whatever you can to help us save lives at sea. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.